For centuries, the Dutch have fought against their arch enemy, water. Because about half of the country is at or below sea level, most of the Netherlands could be underwater if it was not for dikes, levees, pumps and large dams to keep it dry and safe. But sometimes the sea is victorious and floods large areas. The last time that such a disaster happened was in 1953, when a hurricane force storm smashed dikes and dams and inundated large parts of Holland and Zeeland. But during the Dutch War of Independence in the 16th and 17th centuries, the Dutch found an ally in their arch enemy. Their struggle against Spain seemed almost hopeless because the rebels were facing the best trained, supplied and funded European army of that era. As the underdog, they turned to water and used it as a weapon against the Spanish by planning and carrying out a number of military inundations, intentionally flooding enormous swathes of land in order to stop or even defeat the enemy. However, without wanting to go too far down the road of counterfactual history, it is entirely possible that during the Dutch Wars of Independence, the province of Holland could have been permanently flooded and lost to the North Sea, meaning no Rembrandt, no Vermeer and no Dutch Golden Age. The Spanish, seriously hurt by the military inundations, hatched a secret plan that aimed at defeating the Dutch by turning their watery ally against them. Luckily, this plan was never carried out. While Holland survived, the Dutch constructed a line of fortifications and waterworks to facilitate military inundations, which became known as the Dutch Waterline. This militarization of the Dutch landscape had profound long-term political, social and environmental consequences for the province and the region. Welcome to episode 77 of Exploring Environmental History. I'm Jan Oosthoek. In this episode of the podcast, I explore the social, political and environmental issues of military inundation in the Netherlands with Robert Teeks, who is an adjunct professor at Sheridan College in Ontario, Canada. I started my conversation with Robert by asking him when the practice of military inundation started and how it evolved.
From my research, I found that essentially these military inundations, as they're called, began really in the Middle Ages, but they were principally sort of small in size and scale and complexity. They were pretty minor, right? What it evolved was essentially cutting a dike, so digging out a section of a dike or embankment or a dam, opening a sluice, and then just letting gravity and nature sort of take effect, right? Because these are low-lying lands that are protected from flooding by these embankments, right? So during the Middle Ages, you can imagine that the practice began pretty simply, right? You could see some military commander seeing the enemy in some low-lying stretch of land and thinking, well, I could send in my infantry and my cavalry and my archers, or I could just flood the land, right? So in terms of innovation, it's not really that sort of creative, I guess you could say. But during the Dutch Wars of Independence in the late 1500s and 1600s, you see an escalation in terms of military inundations, in terms of scale and complexity. So the first sort of encounter that kicked off the Dutch Wars of Independence was the capture of Brill in 1572, when a band of basically privateers captured the city. And then as the Spanish were moving to retake it, the town carpenter jumped into this canal spontaneously, destroyed the sluice, and then flooded the area around Brill so the Spanish couldn't recapture it. So this was the first encounter of the Dutch Wars of Independence, but it sort of set the tone. In the first 2 decades in particular, military inundations are basically ubiquitous. Every major encounter involves some sort of flooding in one form or another. So it's pretty widespread in the first years in particular. So some of the highlights, I guess, and the major encounters that you see is during the Siege of Alkmaar, or the encounter at Alkmaar, when the Dutch essentially created a water line from the North Sea in the west to the Zuider Zee in the east, and they flooded this stretch of land, and it connected with all these major lakes that sort of dotted the countryside, and it created this entire stretch of land that was flooded, and so the Spanish couldn't cross this. They couldn't traverse this flooded land, so they had to retreat out of the northern quarter of Holland. The one that most people are probably familiar with is the siege and relief of Leiden in 1574. In this particular encounter, this was one of the more dramatic and sort of epic examples of military inundation. So the city of Leiden lies in sort of the center of Holland. And if the Spanish conquered or were able to take Leiden, it's essentially sort of compromised the entire Dutch war effort. Because from there, they could make it to Haarlem, to The Hague, to Gouda, to Rotterdam, all these other cities. So the Spanish essentially sort of did really well isolating Leiden and created these great sort of temporary fortifications to keep out the Dutch from making it, from reaching the city. So what the Dutch planned on doing was essentially just to create this enormous flood, bring water from these major rivers and introduce it to Holland and flood about two-thirds of Holland. And then they could reach the city by boat. So this was about 20 kilometers worth of land that they had to flood. So over the course of about 2 months, the Dutch just kept opening sluices, cutting dikes, and introducing this flood water further and further north until they finally were able to reach Leiden. When it seemed like the effort was going to fail, there was a storm that occurred. There was a shift in winds and some rain, which allowed them to finally sort of reach the city by boat. So there's a bit of a miraculous element to the relief of Leiden, but really, the majority of the flood water was sort of done by the Dutch. So those are some of the two sort of main examples, I guess.
So I can imagine if you flood large areas of land like during the relief of Leiden, that it's quite a damaging practice. If you're a farmer in the area, I don't think that you're exactly enthusiastic about the fact that they're flooding your land. How did the military advantage square up with the disadvantages of temporary loss of farmland and damage to buildings and infrastructure and social disruption? I can imagine it had huge ramifications.
So there's a few things, I guess, to sort of touch on here. In terms of the military advantage, I would say that these military inundations were absolutely vital to the Dutch war effort in the beginning years of the conflict. For the first, I guess, 5 or 6 years or so of the fighting, it was much a civil war as it was a war against the Spanish. So cities like Amsterdam and Middelburg had remained loyal to the Spanish. So the Dutch are fighting themselves as much as are the Spanish, which means that they don't have as much money and sort of resources to put towards the war effort. The early sort of phases of the war are largely financed by William of Orange, and his credit by the end is really stretched to the limit. There's one example of him sort of sneaking out of town as the creditors are trying to sort of collect some payments, right? So it took a while for the States of Holland, the provincial body, to really get its finances and everything in order to support the war effort. So these military inundations are a way of leveling the playing field, so to speak, because at this time, the Spanish forces, the Spanish military was the best in Europe. It was the most well-funded, it was the best trained, it was one of the largest. The Dutch really had their backs up against the wall, so to speak. So these inundations are the only way I would argue that they were able to sort of keep up the war effort in these early years. Almost every single victory that you see in the first decade or two is almost always accompanied by a major military inundation. Like I talked about with the relief of Leiden, Alkmaar, it was the only way to really keep it going. So in terms of a military advantage, I would say that this is one of the only ways forward for the Dutch to keep the war effort going until they could get on sort of solid footing. Once they get going, their army will be one of the best in Europe, and they'll have all sorts of important innovations in the way that they fight. But that took a while. So in the early years, the first decade or two, these floods are absolutely vital to the war effort. In terms of social disruption, there's a couple things that I think are worth pointing out. One is how damaging they were, and another is how society coped with that. So in terms of how damaging these floods were, they were for city centers like Leiden and Rotterdam and some of these other ones, they're generally on higher elevated stretches of land. So cities were less damaged, but the rural sectors were hit especially hard. So for instance, the village of Alphen on the Rhine, which was inundated during the relief of Leiden, according to some research that has been conducted, as much as 93% of the agricultural land in 1575, so a year after the relief of Leiden, 93% of the land is still, according to their words, this was the words that contemporaries used, were still desolate and unusable. So the agricultural land for an entire village is essentially sort of wiped out for a while. The Oblastervoort, which is another rural section of Holland. It had been inundated in 1570 with the All Saints Day flood, which was a natural flood that preceded the Dutch Wars of Independence and made many of these inundations even worse because the Dutch hadn't had a chance to really rebuild a lot of the infrastructure from this naturally occurring flood. So the Alblasser Ward was hit really hard in 1570, and then it was inundated again with the relief of Leiden and several other military campaigns. So over the course of about 7 years, this stretch of land was essentially underwater, except for periodic small little dry spells. The damage was pretty profound. Some villages, according to some chronicles, some villages had trouble even figuring out which properties belonged to who. The boundaries had shifted so much, so it wasn't even clear who owned what stretches of land in some of these villages. In the local level, the rural level, these are really sort of problematic. But it also created a lot of discord between cities. So, for instance, the city of Houda, it had been really upset by some of the breaches during the relief of Leiden. This important dike had been breached in the relief of Leiden, and it remained open. Not only is a lot of this meaning that some flood water is still pouring into the area around Houda, but it also diverted a lot of ship traffic around the city, which meant that Houda was hit sort of on both sides of its ledger, right? It was paying money to try to repair some of these damages from the ongoing flooding, and it wasn't getting as much income because toll revenues were being diverted around the city. So for a while, Houda just simply refused to send delegates to the States of Holland. They said, until this dike is repaired, we're just not participating. The States of Holland drug their feet, and in the end, the city just sent out its own militia to sort of close the breach. So this was very sort of contentious. So in terms of how the Dutch society sort of dealt with these floods, when the States of Holland and the other military leaders proposed these inundations, they always promised some sort of compensation. It was always a bit vague about what that would entail, either repairing the dikes, some sort of compensation for lost harvest. It was always a bit unclear. But over time, it became absolutely obvious that there was no money forthcoming. As one historian said, there was just simply pure lack of funds. The money was still needed for the war effort. What's interesting is that for many people in Dutch society, as damaging as these floods were, most people were just willing to sort of ignore them and get on with it. As one historian famously said, for a lot of people in the Dutch Republic, these wars weren't something to be won or lost. They were just something to be endured, right? These chronicles that I read about the relief of Leiden, almost all of them have this really interesting passage where they talk about the path of the floodwaters towards the city of Leiden, and then this sort of providential interpretation where God sent a change in winds and rain, and that's what saved the city. And then they end the account of the relief of Leiden with this very specific sort of phrase, which almost all the chronicles use. They say, and then, and I'm quoting here, the waters withdrew as if its office and service had been done. So then it just sort of magically just sort of disappeared. And so you see in lots of commemorations and chronicles and remembering things like the relief of Leiden, there's an almost complete sort of willful ignorance about the law, the damage that was actually sort of man-made and directed by the military. But so very much a communal act of forgetting, which is one way that they coped with it.
I can see that from your work, you saying that this Spanish commanders kind of picked up how damaging these inundations were, and they came up with their own cunning plan to use the Dutch own weapon against them on a scale never seen before. I found it kind of an idea of a kind of a nuclear option of the 16th century. So can you explain what the plan was and what the possible consequences would have been for the Netherlands if it had been carried out by the Spanish?
The nuclear option, which I think is an apt term for it. It involved the almost complete eradication, the total sort of destruction of the province of Holland. It involved flooding it irreparably. It began with essentially sort of an intercepted letter when Spanish spies had intercepted this letter from Prince William of Orange, the military leader at this time, the father of the Netherlands, right? So in this letter, the prince talked about which dike he wanted to break. Previous letter, he said, breach this particular dike. And then in this letter, he sort of had a change of heart and said, no, don't breach that one, because if we do, it's going to be too damaging and the damage might be irreparable. So Spanish spies got this letter and then they began sort of passing it up the chain of command. So from here, it goes to the local commander. He reads it, passes it on to the governor general of the Netherlands, the Duke of Alva. His nickname is the Iron Duke. So it gives you every indication of what he probably thought about this plan. He read this letter and he thought, well, this is worth exploring. He had a local Dutch surveyor create a map, which would have detailed specifically which dikes would have needed to be cut to permanently destroy Holland, right? So a few dikes along the North Sea, some sea dikes, a few of the major dikes along the important riverways, and then some dikes along the Zuider Zee, and Holland would have been sunk forever. Duke of Alva creates this plan, creates this map, sends it along to Philip II, and then Philip II stews on it for quite a while. In terms of what it would have meant, like possible consequences for the Netherlands or the Dutch Republic, I don't want to put too strong of a point on this, but it would have essentially sort of entailed sort of a minor genocide here, right? We're talking about the complete destruction of an entire province here without warning. So it seems in all, if it would have gone down, Holland would have been lost permanently, or at least for a considerable period of time. And then there probably would have been increased flooding risks of the adjoining provinces. The provinces further inland probably would have experienced sort of further flood risk, because at the time, Holland had a series of dikes which protected these more inner provinces, and they probably would have sort of suffered as well.
So it would have really meant the use of a weapon of mass destruction.
Yeah, and I think the term you use there, a nuclear option, I think that's a great summarization of it.
So, but it was never carried out. So why was it never carried out?
So as I mentioned, the Duke of Alva passed it up to the Spanish King, Philip II, and he considered it for a while, and he actually felt justified doing it. If he would have gone through with it, he felt it was completely within his rights for a couple of reasons. One, the Dutch were at this time subjects of Philip II. So what they were doing in fighting against him, rebelling, was an act of treason. These were traitors that he was dealing with, which is one of the worst things you can be in the early modern world, right? Secondly, this was also during the wars of religion. Lots of Dutch people were practicing the Reformed religion, so they were heretics in his eyes as well. So the fact that he was dealing with traitors and heretics, he felt that he would have been completely within his rights to go with this nuclear option. But he decided against it for a couple of reasons. One, this was in the very early days of the conflict, which would go on for about 80 years. But this plan was developed sort of early on. And at this time, Holland was still one of his possessions, so he didn't want to destroy his own property, right? So that was one reason. The second reason is a bit ironic. He was worried about the Spanish developing a bad reputation around Europe for carrying out this nuclear option. He worried that it would have sort of a knock-on effect, and the Spanish would develop this reputation for being barbarous and, you know, all sorts of horrible things. But it's ironic because during the course of the war, Spanish soldiers committed a number of atrocities, and they earned a really horrible reputation anyway, right? They sacked, they plundered, they raped a number of cities across the Netherlands and the Low Countries. And so they developed a bad reputation anyway. So it's kind of ironic that he rejected it on this ground.
Later on, when the Dutch Republic is more or less secure and the War of Independence is more or less won, but rumbles a bit on, the Dutch authorities are going to construct sluice works and things like that to kind of create this real water line. It's not the scale of the 19th and 20th century. They built these waterworks, they built fortifications. So how did that change the landscape? Because in a way, it's creating a military landscape. So it's changing the environment. So what impacts did you find in your research?
My research sort of ends with the construction of that first waterline, the Old Holland waterline. I'm less familiar with that, but I've carried out quite a bit of research on sort of individualized locations, so very specific sort of defenses. What I found in this period of fortification building is essentially what the Dutch tried to do was harmonize environmental and military defenses. So finding ways that the environment, sort of the swampy, waterlogged parts of the landscape, would support the military defenses. So they found that what worked best is when these two arenas or these two components were in harmony, right? So throughout the Dutch Wars of Independence, the early stages of the Dutch War of Independence, most of these fortifications were medieval-style fortifications, and so they were completely outdated. In the first couple encounters that I talked about, such as at Leiden, lots of the fortifications are sort of outdated, and it's just the tenacity of the defenders that are able to keep the Spanish at bay. But then over the course of the next decade or two or three, they begin sort of modernizing these defenses. And they develop what's called the Old Netherlandish system of fortification, these bastion fortifications that use the water as an important component of their defense. So they create these really elaborate wet ditches, so sort of moats of sort, canals or large canals that run around cities that will allow to them to sort of keep the attackers at bay, right, and prevent the attackers from reaching the walls of the city where they could plant explosives and then gain entrance to the city and storm it. They find that what works best is that when they can sort of harmonize environmental defenses with military defenses. So in many ways, what they found is that the same dikes that would protect the countryside would run into many of the cities, and so that protected the country would become part of the bastion or the walls that protected the city. So they had to create sort of systems whereby they could keep enough water in the wet ditches, they could make sure that the dikes were protecting the countryside, and then also protecting the city, if that makes sense. Right. So it was very much sort of a harmonizing effect.
It's fascinating to see that the particular Dutch environment is creating this very unique kind of militarized landscape that is, well, I think unique if you look at the rest of Europe.
One thing that's interesting is if you look at Google Maps today and you look at some of these cities that had these early fortifications, you can still see from an aerial view the waterways that went around these cities and the way the fortifications actually sort of went around, say, cities like Gorkum or Brill or some of these other ones. So it's still very much present on the landscape.
So in a way, the backbone of the Dutch landscape, I mean, especially in the western part of the country, is still built around these watercourses built for the Dutch waterline.
Yeah, for sure.
From your research, do you also get a sense that not only the Dutch landscape and environment have been shaped by this waterline, but it also shaped politics and society? To what extent is that true?
So I see two main areas where these military practices impact Dutch politics and society. The first one in terms of politics is that these military inundations created a situation that allowed people with skills in water management to begin moving up through the political ladder in a way that wouldn't have been possible during times of peace. The best example I found in my research is Johan van Oldenbarnevelt, who is really the architect of the Dutch Republic. He helped draft the Union of Utrecht, which was essentially became kind of the de facto constitution for the Dutch Republic. But before the war broke out, there was nothing in his past that seemed that sort of destined him for greatness, I guess you could say. Before the war broke out, he was working in the Court of Holland as sort of this low-level bureaucrat working on dike management issues. He was a master or an expert in medieval dike laws. So financing dikes, organizing sort of repair works, things of that nature. And in this role, he created a number of important sort of contacts. But he remained a low-level bureaucrat or a low-level official in the Court of Holland. But then during the course of the war, there's a great need for people with expertise in water management. So you see Oldenbarnevelt sort of pulled into this orbit of politics that might not have been available before. So for instance, during the relief of Leiden, he worked on a commission to help coordinate these floods with local water board and polder officials and local village magistrates to try to limit the damage from the flood. You see that he's sort of being brought into this world of politics because of his expertise in water management. So he's involved in the relief of Leiden. And then later on, he's appointed to a committee that helps repair some dikes in Zeeland that had been flooded with another military inundation. It's his job as part of this commission to find a way to finance the dike repairs. And it's pretty complicated negotiations, but in the end, he's able to find the monies to pay for these dike repairs. And from this point on, he becomes an important sort of ambassador between Holland and Zeeland, even though they were allies, right? They still had to coordinate their war efforts. And he becomes an important figure in this sort of relationship, right? So it's his expertise that sort of sets him on the path. So that's one really important political development.
I can also imagine that the power of engineers increased during the conflict because of the inundations that were needed and the way that sluices and were operated. And
that's another way that these military matters influence Dutch society, where some of these technologies that are developed not necessarily for the military but by military engineers has a sort of a knock-on effect and an influence beyond just the military arena. So the best example of that is Simon Stevin. He was one of these great military engineers who helped design some of these fortifications and provide a real theoretical underpinning for the old Netherlander system of fortification, which I talked about. In 1589, when he's sort of really busy with the war effort, he patents this system known as the Molengang system, which was essentially sort of an organization whereby a number of water lifting mills could sort of work in tandem and reclaim lakes. So at this time, the average polder mill could lift water about a meter and a half, which meant that the Dutch ability to drain lands was fairly limited, right? It was only a meter and a half. So he created essentially this step-like system. On each step, there was a mill and a reservoir. The lowest step, there would be a mill which would drain water, lift it a meter and a half, deposit it in a reservoir, and then there'd be a mill on the next step that would take the water from that reservoir, raise it a meter and a half, and then deposit another reservoir, and so on and so forth. This Molengang system, the ability to drain lakes and other land is really sort of increased. But because he's so busy with the war effort, he's not able to capitalize on this development. And so in 1609, his patent expires, and another individual, Jan Leywater, is able to take this patent and begin draining lakes throughout the northern quarter. So lakes like Beemster, Purmeer, Schermeer, Wormeer, these really dominating or these really large lakes in the northern quarter were drained over the course of about 30 years. So in total, about 26,000 hectares of land is drained and reclaimed. About 10 million guilders worth of investment is sort of pumped into these reclamation schemes. And these lakes that are drained become absolutely sort of gold mines for the investors. They become really agricultural productive lands. It completely sort of overhauls the landscape of the northern quarter. So that's another way that the military arena sort of overflowed and impacted Dutch politics and society.
Well, actually, it impacted hugely on the Dutch landscape because it made a huge parts of, well, North Holland. And without the war inundations and the technology that came with it, that would never have happened. But it also left a legacy for the present day. These land reclamations, but also the Dutch water line is still very visible in the landscape. So do you think that the construction of the Dutch water line and the way that the Dutch viewed the environment at the time and the way it was managed has altered or even engineered the way that the Dutch view their struggle against the water, they view their country and environment they live in at the present day?
Yeah, so I see a couple of different sort of lingering effects from this. The use of the environment, I would say, during this war sort of changed their mentality, which was a trend that was sort of going on before the war. Right before the war kicked off, the Dutch were already becoming much more sort of aggressive in their fight against their archenemy, the sea, as you talk about. For a large part of the Middle Ages, it's really about defending from floods. But then in the 1400s and 1500s, they develop better polder mills, and they begin finding ways to get peat, which was situated below the water level. And all of this entails sort of a more offensive or sort of aggressive approach to their environment. So already they're sort of becoming much more aggressive with their environment. And then, so during the war, there's sort of this uneasy relationship that I see developing, where the sea or water had been traditionally sort of their arch enemy. But for this sort of temporary period, they enlist the water for their own benefit, right? But it's this uneasy alliance because of all the damages and destruction which that entails, right? So I see this attempt by the Dutch to enlist the environment to help them with their defense, but they want to make sure that the landscape is sort of behaving in predictable and organized and systematized ways, right? So that water line that we talk about, essentially what that did is it essentially sort of created a prepackaged flood. Many of the other floods that I talked about were more or less improvised. The relief of Leiden, Alkmaar, those were done sort of on the spot. these water lines were pre-designed, and it was very clear which areas would be inundated and which ones wouldn't. And that was an attempt by the Dutch to make the environment sort of behave a little bit. These early inundations, those improvised ones, were absolutely destructive. So many negatives associated with that. But at the same time, they achieved a great deal of military worth, right? They helped them achieve lots of their military objectives. So it's too useful of an idea to discard, but it just needs to be tweaked. So you see this attempt to systematize and it makes the environment behave in very predictable ways. And so I would say that attempt to sort of systematize and regularize and organize the environment in sort of into these very sort of constricting ways persisted throughout a lot of Dutch history up until the flood in the 1950s when that was the worst flood ever hit the Netherlands struck. And then after that point, there's sort of a move away from sort of constraining the environment to very specific sort of avenues. There's a focus more on letting the environment take more natural routes, keeping floodplains open to sort of allow nature to sort of take more natural routes, if that makes sense.
Yes, but on the other hand, what I see still in Dutch society is that it's still about systematizing the landscape and the environment and also make it predictable, make it manageable. And that is a trait of the Dutch character that is extremely strong. They believe that the environment can be made and controlled. That never went away. It's still there. Probably can trace it indeed to the wars of Dutch independence and possibly even before in the Middle Ages. So yeah, it's interesting how you're sketching this kind of continuing attitude towards landscape, water management, systematizing the landscape and the environment. Yeah, it's all still there today. Well, thank you very much for this fascinating conversation. I could talk much longer about it, but I think this is really, really very interesting research. And I'm looking actually forward to your book when it is going to come out. So thank you very much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you so much for this opportunity. I really enjoyed it. So thank you very much.
That is Robert Teeks on the history of military inundations in the Netherlands. On his website, you can read more about the history of military inundations during the Dutch War of Independence. This site also contains an interactive map of flooding in the Low Countries between 1570 and 1588. You can access this map at roberttieks.com. Robert Teeks recently published a blog post on the Network in Canadian History and Environment site discussing his work on military inundations. You can read this blog post at niche-canada.org. This brings me to the end of this long episode of the podcast. I hope that you enjoyed this show and that you will be joining me next time for another episode of Exploring Environmental History. This is Jan Oosthoek from Brisbane, Australia.